Our second speaker of the day is Alan Bergman. He's currently the president and CEO of the Brain Injury Association, which is located in Alexandria, Virginia. In this role, Mr. Bergman provides leadership in several areas, including prevention of brain injury, research and treatment and rehabilitation, and improving the quality of life for people with brain injuries as well as their families. Mr. Bergman is a recognized expert on health and human service policy issues at both the federal and state levels. He also has expertise in issues related to health care, managed care, and long-term care. In recent years, he's applied his knowledge to a variety of issues at the federal level, including Medicaid and Medicare, health care, managed care, and family support services. In addition, he provides ongoing technical assistance at the state level on a variety of issues, including state public policy analysis, service system delivery, planning for and evaluation of block grants, Medicaid waivers, and planning in Medicaid-managed care. During the past 9 years, Mr. Bergman has served as a consultant to several task forces and committees of the National Conference of State Legislatures. This work is focused on developmental disabilities, health care, planning and stakeholder facilitation, long-term care, Medicaid, and fiscal policy. In addition, he has served as a project director for numerous federal grants and contracts, and he's provided policy analysis, planning, and stakeholder facilitation in a variety of states across the country. Today, Mr. Bergman will be addressing issues related to long-term care for non-elderly individuals with disabilities, and it's my pleasure to welcome Mr. Bergman.
Thank you for the introduction, and I'm very pleased to be here. And I think as Robin pointed out, and she's going to see, I used some of the same slides that she did, so I guess redundancy is okay. Higher ed people, right? Wisconsin has been a leader, in fact, in an area that I spent over 10 years in called family support. This state was an early pioneer in state public policy in the area of developmental disabilities in giving resources to families with children with developmental disabilities as caregivers in order for those families to maintain their children at home. And in fact, we modeled in a number of states off of what you were doing here, including cash subsidy work in the neighboring state of Michigan. In addition, you have been doing work in the Wisconsin Partnership Program, which is again frontier work in long-term care. So I find it exciting to be here because some of us use you as a point of reference when we do work in other states and even at the federal level. And the topic is timely, as Robin pointed out. And when we cut to it, this topic really is about three things: public policy values, demographics, and money. The numbers are off the chart, as Robin began to show you. And I'll do one parochial brief commercial for my new engagement in traumatic brain injury. The CDC tells us today we have 5.1 million children and adults with long-term disability as a result of traumatic brain injury. Prior to 1980, there were very few. This population is primarily a result of breakthroughs in medical technology and trauma care, and people living who used to die before they got to the hospital, very simply. Many of them, again, incidents we're looking at 90 to 100,000 per year, are added to the rolls of persons with severe long-term permanent disability. Could be physical, could be emotional, could be cognitive, could be a combination of all three. And so we're moving forward in seeing the numbers go up across these areas as we move to the 21st century. One of the first things that's somewhat different about the younger population is, and as Robin pointed out, I think in the early 90s, we merged elderly and non-elderly together around long-term care, but a value base in the non-elderly population that has really tried to get away from the care piece, smacking of paternalism, maternalism, somebody taking care of you, whereas the disability movement has been pursuing independence, interdependence, and this whole autonomy, choice, and control. So the emerging term is really long-term services and supports rather than long-term care. And I know it sounds like wordsmithing, but for somebody with a disability who's grown up in the civil rights independent living movement, this is not wordsmithing. This is a conveyance of values and what is it that government is trying to do. Again, if we look at who we're talking about a lot of people. If we look at long-term care needs based on the ADLs and IADLs that Robin referred to using 1990 data, we're talking about almost 25% of the disability population having long-term care needs. And if you look at how that breaks out across the age span, approximately half of it is people under 65 and half people over 65. So although the proportion of people over 65 is larger who need long-term care, if we look at the total universe of the population as a whole, about half of the people who have the long-term care needs are under 65, and you can even see there's a small slice of them who are under the age of 17, 3.4% in the right chart. This is a major issue for the country and for the states. If we take it down and look even inside of Medicaid, which is where we tend to focus because that is the government-funded long-term care population, again, we are talking about a significant number of people who have long-term care needs, and if you extrapolate this to your own state and begin to look at who's in and who's out, there are more people who are out than who are in, and as Robin's data showed you, family caregiving and informal caregiving are still the primary means by which people get their long-term care or long-term services and supports, and that's for the under 65 population as much as the over 65 population. There's Medicaid expenditures, and probably the important thing to look at is the red zone. The red zone is long-term care. About 36% of Medicaid is in long-term care, and as you can see, most of it is nursing homes and ICFMR, which is the institutional program in developmental disabilities. Mental health there is IMD, that's also institutional. Home health is everything else. Home health, personal care, all the 200 home and community-based waivers, 200 plus, and targeted case management. So as Robin showed in one of hers, we still have a very strong institutionally oriented long-term care system in Medicaid. Different slice of the pie charts that Robin showed you, but why I think this issue will continue to be a front burner issue for you. On the left-hand side is the Medicaid population. The yellow is, the kids, now known as the TANF kids, and these are the parents, the moms. But as you can see, we don't spend a lot of money on them. But if we go up here, this is the under 65 SSI population. This is the elderly population. Here are the resource allocations. So as states and policymakers struggle with out-year growth and cost containment, we've probably done most of what we're going to get done here. These are the areas that you're looking at in terms of what are the issues that you have to deal with. If we look at what's happened historically in the mental retardation developmental disability institutions, as a case in point, deinstitutionalization has really come way down. In fact, the new numbers were looking someplace around 50,000. And again, Wisconsin has been sort of politically stuck on this issue. And there are lots of political forces that play to this. But again, just so you have an external point of reference, we now have the states of, and they're small, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Rhode Island, District of Columbia, and New Mexico that are public institution free. There is nobody with a developmental disability living in a public institution in those states. Minnesota and Colorado probably in the next year or two will be out of the institutional business, as will the neighbors in the state of Michigan. So part of this was done on values. A lot of it more recently has been done on economics. But just to know that there seems to be no needed reason for a person with a developmental disability to be in an ICFMR facility. It doesn't mean people don't have 24-hour support needs or care needs, but they don't necessarily have to be met in that kind of a setting. And it becomes an issue of money. The expenditures continue to go up. You don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar to figure this out. In 1996, the average ICFMR bed on the public side was $100,000 per year per person. In the state of Oregon, a place called Fairview, $500 a day. Now you're bumping $200,000 per year per person for 316 people. They have been in court in Oregon more times than they would care to think about. They have had the Office of Civil Rights, the Department of Justice, HICVA surveyors, and what have you. And every time they're in noncompliance, the answer is throw more staff at the problem. They never get to the training part that Robin talked about. They just throw more staff at the problem. And now you can't tell the staff from the residents at Fairview. And finally, the legislature has agreed with the governor to close the place. And it didn't have anything to do with values. It had to do with economics. And that's an outrageous amount of money for anybody to spend on an average. There may be some people who need that level of support, may even need more than that. But that was the average per diem at Fairview in Salem, Oregon, which, by the way, is a very low cost of living community. So it's not like this was Manhattan, New York, or Chicago. I think Robin had this one up also, showing the major changes between 87 and 97 in Medicaid and the growth in the home and community-based waiver by about a third. However, if you look and tally up, even in 1997, in the 1997 column, let me use my wonderful pointer here, what you will see is in long-term care, there was still $56 million. And out of that, most of it was spent on the institutional side, 32 plus in nursing homes and about 10 in the ICFMR, so that it's still a heavily skewed institutional spending pattern in this country. And the real challenge, I think, for public policy now is equity. Equity at two levels. Equity within the system of people currently eligible, and equity for those who are equally eligible if we move toward a functionality assessment rather than a diagnostic assessment, which is certainly what's proposed, in the Governor's Family Care Initiative, and where we're seeing a lot of states beginning to get to. But as Robin pointed out, do we have the tools, do we have the instruments that across various populations will get you to that level of equity? And again, putting on my new hat around traumatic brain injury, where the issues are really somewhat different from the traditional long-term support populations, do we have an assessment tool that will give you a functional score that will come out as an equity score compared to someone with severe mental retardation or someone who is frail, elderly, with diabetes and coronary issues? And I'm not sure we have that answer yet, but that's really the challenge in public policy, is how do we begin to move toward functionality, which will make the special interest groups come off the wall, but at the same time, from a public policy perspective, why should we continue to say that somebody who got here early gets all the goodies and somebody who is equally functionally needy because they don't have the right diagnostic tag gets nothing and they're left out in the cold? And that happens throughout the under 65 population in this country living because there isn't a system that has been put in place for them. You have some here, some states have pockets, but that group is terribly underserved by the community system, and often those folks by default end up in nursing homes. And in most cases, they don't want to be there, but it's the only place they can get those supports and those assistance. The alternative strategy for policymakers is then, if you're not going to get toward equity and some kind of perhaps managed care or rearrangement, you have to limit eligibility, you have to reduce or eliminate services, you have to restrict access to service, or, of course, we do have the other side of the coin, which is you can begin to double and triple expenditures in the out years and just keep doing more of the same. And I don't think any state is prepared to do that, nor necessarily do you need to do that. You'll need to spend based on demographics. We have a new piece now that begins to change, perhaps, this issue around setting. In the Americans with Disabilities Act, passed in 1990, there is, under Title II, which is state and local government services, a lot of talk about what the responsibilities are. A public entity shall, that's a mandate, that's one of those nasty unfunded mandates, legislators, in a civil rights law, administer services, programs, and activities in the most integrated setting appropriate to the needs of qualified individuals with disabilities. This is a major change from traditional disability rights language and public policy around the least restrictive environment. This sort of turns the coin the other way and says we're pushing in statute most integrated. Now, what does that have to do with Medicaid? Well, it has to do with it a lot because there have been some recent court cases which are now going to be challenged in the Supreme Court, one from Georgia, the Olmstead case, one from Pennsylvania, the Helen L. case, where under the Americans with Disabilities Act and Medicaid, individuals who were in nursing homes, and one was in a mental health facility, who did not need to be there but were there because there weren't the appropriate supports in the community, or at least the funding for the appropriate supports. The community was full, the slots were open in the institution, not in the community. Their lawyers got them out, and the states were forced to redirect resources for those community supports. Sally Richardson, with HCFA then, put out a letter to the states last July with the citation I gave you on the previous slide, in a letter saying, I urge you to develop home and community-based service options for persons with disabilities to live in integrated settings. We'll see what the Supreme Court says. About 15 states have signed on as amicus to Georgia. I don't remember whether Wisconsin did or not. On the side of the state saying that the federal government, under a civil rights law, has no right to dictate the states its public policy on how it spends its Medicaid long-term care dollars. Sometime this year, the court will decide. But I would hope, regardless of the court decision, that we would take a look at a context of disability in terms of the landmark civil rights legislation for people with disabilities in this country. So where does managed care fit? This is a piece that I put together a couple of years ago, and I think whether it's called managed care or not in terms of the Family Care Initiative, it really is an opportunity to shift or share risk. And one of the things that may need to go back on the drawing board here, Tom, is do you share any risk, or is it all pushed downstream among payers, providers, and consumers through a contracted process of capitated reimbursements and performance outcomes in exchange for program flexibility and decreased regulation? That's the hope of managed care. What I find as I travel around the country to states and dealing with the state Medicaid agency and the aging and disability agencies is the inability to do the last part of this, which is to give the decreased regulation and increased program flexibility with the transfer of risk and the capitation. And for public policymakers, I think that's the struggle. Are you prepared to loosen the reins in exchange for transferring risk? And are you prepared to then come up with accountability measures in the world of outcomes as opposed to all the process and input stuff that we've traditionally called quality in this country? So the potential of managed care is individualized plans, increased coordination and care management, maybe the integration of services, as Robin talked about, continuity of care, early intervention, prevention, particularly secondary and tertiary conditions. We know this population, both under 65 and over 65, have major issues because of their chronic illness or disability. We need to begin to deal with those in a preventative kind of way, and managed care, at least theoretically, holds that promise. Reduced incentives for institutionalization. Again, if I'm a risk-sharing or risk-taking partner with the state, and I have a choice to package up some supports over here in the home or in the community versus paying a per diem to an institutional environment, assuming I can do it for equal or less, there are some incentives in the system, which traditionally there really have not been in most states, to do that kind of bundling of the program. But there are some risks, and I think these are the ones that policymakers will hear about and need to be thinking about. There is the potential to reduce access to service, to reduce the quality if we're not sure what quality is. There's a risk of underservice to people with extensive needs. That is, what happens to the person who costs more than that average payment or capitation rate? Now, all of us know, even with case mix adjustments in nursing homes and in the ICFMR program, there are people who cost lots more than that caseload mix pays. And if we ever tracked an average per diem, we would find very few people get the average. People get above or below. So there has to be assurances, and these are rights protections, which appear to be built into your plan, that people really get what they need, and they're not shortchanged by that managed care entity to say, well, we only got $50,000, and that's all you get is $50,000. Well, if you're going to be able to pocket $20,000 profit on somebody who only costs $30,000, but you got paid $50,000, you might have to spend $70,000 or $75,000 on that other person, and that's what managed care is about. Next, potential of over-medicalization. Again, there are issues here in the healthcare world but in the disability community under 65, and I think increasingly even in the elderly population now, the medical model, the doctor running it all, the nurse running it all, is anathema to independent living and a psychosocial model. So there's just concerns, who's going to run this thing? And also over medication. One of the ways to deal with people who are assertive and empowered is to just pop a little extra Thorazine and say, now we've solved the problem. Also helps keep the cost low because people can't do much. Again, may not happen, but as policymakers, you need to understand the downside potentials as well. Money is what this is all about. Saul Feldman is the CEO of U.S. Behavioral Health, but he used to work in the real community. And I think this is part of the special interest issues in the provider community in some places. I don't know if it's true here. But we've sort of had open-ended kind of funding. And what Saul says is the system brought it on itself to capitate. I'm not sure that's totally true, but at least it's worth thinking about. And then we have the era of competition, and Chronicle of Philanthropy, which some of us read rather religiously, had a lead story last August. Competition, pardon the typo, from for-profit businesses leading to major challenges for the nonprofit world. Businesses are staking out territory in healthcare, education, social services, and many other areas. The for-profit folks are looking at this because there's a lot of money, and they do believe they can rearrange the system and turn it around. Lastly, and it is part of your plan, and there will be a hearing tomorrow at the Senate Finance Committee where your secretary and I will be testifying to try to get some real work incentives in this country for people on disability. Again, this is being driven primarily now from a policy perspective on numbers. This is the amount of money spent last 2 years ago, $74 billion on cash assistance to working age adults with disabilities, projected to be $104 billion. In the year 2002. Once you get on the SSI or SSDI rolls, the odds are you don't get off. And we've got to recraft policy. It's part of your proposal, but we have to do it nationally to give states the latitude to allow people to go to work, to make a contribution. And even if we make a dent in this, a couple of percent, those numbers begin to shift. And then these folks will make contributions to the economy as well. I think I have like 1 minute left. Here's one that I think is staggering to us in this field. Since the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which was in here, the proportion of working age people with disabilities employed has decreased significantly. This is from the latest Harris poll. I don't understand it. I'm not sure there's a good explanation because the disincentives around work and health insurance, Medicaid, and Medicare haven't changed. They've gotten a little bit better. This is a very depressing statistic in the disability community, particularly with the low unemployment rates and the booming economy. So we're hoping that we move some legislation that will make this easier. It's part of your plan. Most people with disabilities say they want to work. Employers want to hire qualified people who can do a job. We've got to get that fit to come back together. Because otherwise, here's the end game. The biggest synonym for severe disability in the country today is poverty. And that doesn't help the individual, it doesn't help the family, and it doesn't help the country. And with that, I will end. Thank you.
Okay, questions?
That slide you had right toward the end about the drop in the number of disabled persons working that you found so shocking, what was the absolute numbers in terms of the number of disabled people working? I mean, because earlier in your talk, you talked about the vast explosion in the number of working-age adults with disabilities.
Yeah, good question. I don't have the raw data in front of me, but what I can tell you is it was a significant change in the percentage. It was an absolute decrease in the pure number as well. Not as much, obviously, because the numbers have gone up, but the actual number of people is down.
I think you answered it. I was going to say maybe there's a change in the composition of adults with a disability. That would account for the decrease in the percentage that are working if they were more severely brain injured. So if the composition is changing, then the proportion could go down. They have nothing to do with the incentives. But you said the absolute number is going down as well.
Yeah, and that's the frightening piece, particularly with the breakthroughs in technology across disability to enhance people's capacity to contribute.
We've got another question here in the back.
one job.
Thank you. Could you comment on the competition? Where we seem to be heading is a competition of managed care and private providers, for-profit providers, and we have a whole network of volunteers and nonprofits out there, and one of their arguments is that when it becomes nonprofit, I'm unlikely to volunteer to deliver meals for Aurora Healthcare versus the Long-Term Commission on Aging or whatever other nonprofit that's there, that if they get absorbed in the increase, and there's a whole variety of things, not just meals, but there's a whole variety of things that are now done through volunteers.
Wow, thank you. I didn't even plant it. I am a firm believer, just so we know the bias, in the voluntary nonprofit community agency system with all of its flaws and foibles, and it has many. And what I worry about is the for-profit New York Stock Exchange companies. I'm not talking about the mom-and-pop for-profit. There are about a half a dozen that I've been tracking the last 3 or 4 years. They're all recommended, by the way, as good buys by stockbrokers. I'm talking about Magellan. I'm talking about Merit. I'm talking about U.S. Behavioral Health. I'm talking about ResCare. I mean, these folks are for real. They're very good at what they do. My challenge to the nonprofit community is the small agencies can't make it. They've got to network, they've got to form alliances, they've got to do some things together to share the admin costs in order to be able to compete, and they've got to have data systems. If you're going to play in this world of managed care cost competition, you've got to know what it costs. I can tell you about ResCare. I've been to their corporate headquarters. You can go to Kentucky. They will pull up for you. They do residential in mental retardation, developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injury, and then they do juvenile corrections. They have two major product lines. They're a diversified company. I mean, that's the language we're starting to talk in this field, good, bad, or indifferent. They will pull up for you on a screen the profile, without names, of the people who live in any of their group homes, any place in the country, age, level of disability, support need, their individual program plan. And more so than that, they can pull up for you what the choices are for dinner tonight in that particular setting and how much it costs to the penny to prepare that meal. I have yet to find nonprofit community agencies who have that ability to sophisticatedly put together a data set. How can they bid competitively? Should they be able to? Absolutely. It's an infrastructure capacity building issue. I don't believe there's anything the for-profits do that the nonprofits, if they'll get off their turf, can't do. But if they decide to fight among themselves, I think states and counties ultimately will have no choice but based on cost to go to the for-profits. And then I'm really, because this is on tape, sticking my neck out. My biggest concern with the for-profits is not the short term, it's the long term. They'll squeeze out all the profit and then they'll walk away and then we're going to have to rebuild what we've spent 20 to 50 years building. So let's help the community agencies figure out how to be really competitive. Because I think we can do more with less, but we got to change the way we do business.
One more.
Just two quick ones. Regarding the disability figures of employment.
Yes, sir.
Are we not finding, though, that some of the borderline cases that were classified disabled are now being reclassed and no longer on that disabled orientation? Because I know I have constituents that were classified disabled, had training, sought employment, and were removed from that classification, so that eliminates them from that number. And the second one is not the healthcare facilities numbers always going to be significantly larger? As an example, we had one parent for 12 years, one of the other parents at the same time for 6 months, and are not in that figures until they're placed, then they are extremely costly individuals, so will not healthcare always have a significantly larger disproportionate number of cost into the healthcare home versus the other options?
All right, let me start with the first one, if I can even remember it, which was around the employment, employment issues and people coming off of the disability roles. Clearly that happened with children after the Personal Responsibility and Work Reconciliation Act in 96, where a lot of kids were taken off the SSI rolls. But the continuing disability reviews were only a hot issue in the early Reagan years for people with mental health issues. But there haven't been that many shifts in the last several years around the SSI, SSDI rolls in terms of tightening up eligibility or throwing people off. So I don't think that's a legitimate issue there. in terms of once somebody goes into a facility, what does that do to the facility numbers and costs? Clearly, as Robin showed you, there are a cohort of people who are going to spend, at least under the current scenario, 10 years or more in a skilled nursing facility. I think the public policy goal is how do you do that intense setting cost avoidance as much as possible? How do you incentivize families and communities and support agencies to do that as long as possible? And I think there is a difference between the under 65 developmental disabilities, physical disability world, and the over 65 world, because I'm not an expert there, in terms of the nursing home issue versus the ICFMR issue. And I think I've given you enough states that have closed them without any substantive repercussions that that's a different issue. There are clearly some very frail, elderly people who at some point the caregiving capacity in the community is such it can't be dealt with and the person does need a skilled facility, and those costs will be high, and the over 85 population are the folks who are going to be moving in that direction.